The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I am honored to introduce our guests this evening. Claire Massoud is the author of 6 best-selling and acclaimed works of fiction, including The Emperor's Children, When the World Was Steady, The Hunters, The Last Life, The Woman Upstairs, and The Burning Girl. She is a Penn Faulkner Award finalist, the recipient of Guggenheim and Radcliffe Fellowships, and the winner of the Strauss Living Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She teaches writing at Harvard University. She's here this evening with her new novel, This Strange Eventful History, which a review in The Guardian called almost unbearably moving, wise, and full of the most gorgeous prose. She'll be joined in conversation this evening with Laura McGrath, assistant professor of English at Temple University, and a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
Hello. Thank you all for joining us on this rainy, dreary evening. I'm so excited to be here and to be here with our wonderful guest, Claire Massoud, to talk about this wonderful novel that just came out yesterday, This Strange Eventful History. Oh, Claire, thank you so much for being with us.
Laura, thank you for being here with me, and thank you everyone for coming this evening.
So I want to first start just by telling you how much I loved this novel. It was just such a pleasure to read. And in particular, these character portraits were just so artfully and intricately drawn. To feel a part of a family, to be able to watch this family proceed over generations. And I found myself toward the end, probably about 3/4 in, wondering what other characters would think or how they would respond to the particular events that were happening on the page. I think, I wonder what Barbara thinks about that. Or, oh, Denise is going to have something to say, I think.
I think, you know, it was George Eliot who said of fiction, the nearest thing to life. And I think for me as a reader, character is a big part of why I read fiction and a big part of why I write fiction. I'm interested in human behavior and human relationships and dynamics in pretty well every area of life, I guess. So plot is less obvious for me. I don't mind if there's not much plot, but I know some people care a lot more about it. I'm so glad that you felt that way because for me, it really is a character-driven book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now let's talk about these characters in particular in relationship to you. I have some of the lowest hanging fruit questions. You know, obviously, this is a novel, and you tell us at the very beginning that the usual rules apply. But as keen readers certainly have noticed, there's a lot of similarities between your life and your family and the characters here in this novel. Your grandfather, I understand, also wrote a 1,500-page handwritten family memoir. And so I'm curious about your relationship to this source text, your relationship to these characters before you began.
Right. So I can't say autobiographical because it isn't so much about my life, but I guess it is the most drawn from life fiction that I've ever written. That said, I was explaining to somebody the other day, because I think it's hard for people to understand sometimes that fiction writing always involves making things up. that actually, I would contend that a bunch of nonfiction writing also involves making things up in varying degrees. I was likening it to papier-mâché. So you have a form, and then you're and then you're sort of swaddling that form with all sorts of gunk. And then you end up with a shape that is related to what you started with, but maybe quite far from it in places. So my grandfather's, it's perhaps worth saying that the novel covers spans 7 decades from 1940 to 2010, and there's a sort of section each decade with different points of view in that section. You know, there's this Martin Amis in The Information, I think, sort of has the we're supposed to laugh at the narrator when he writes about having written a novel with 7 unreliable narrators, and I feel like I've sort of 7 decades, 5 different points of view. It seems a little like a farce, but my grandfather's memoir covered 1928 to 1946, and the first of these sections is 1940, and it ends in 2010. So it's worth saying that I read my grandfather's memoir, and I read it in its entirety only in 2017. I'd read little pieces before, but I'd not read the whole thing. And when I read it initially, I thought, I must do something with this. And I had been thinking for many years that I wanted to write about my family's history or something related to my family's history. And initially I thought, you know, what can I do with this text, which is full of wonderful stories, some gossipy, you know, who knew? Maybe you did know that he was a naval attaché in Beirut. He was the French naval attaché in Beirut before the war. Turns out he was very Catholic. He and my grandmother were very much in love, but it was a big wife-swapping scene, and he, you know, writes about that in his memoir. We were children when he wrote it, but he was not involved in the wife-swapping, but he was just letting us know what it was like. So, you know, full of interesting stuff, and yet I couldn't. I couldn't see a novel, and I'm a novelist, and that making up of things, is just who I am. So there was the memoir. Then there were also family letters, lots of family letters from the 50s and 60s. And for me, reading those, to just have a sense of who these people were before I was around, it completely, you know, not in relation to me, just as people, young people with dreams and ambitions and disappointments. Yeah, so I suppose it wasn't in some way different, perhaps, than writing a historical novel of any kind, right? That you do a certain amount of research and then you're trying to make it come alive.
So you didn't, or maybe you did, feel a sense of conflict between, you know, Claire Massoud, the celebrated novelist, and Claire Massoud, the family member here, working with your grandfather's manuscript, working with family letters, things like that.
So I think for me, there's several things I'd say. One is that papier-mâché sort of process is, mix a metaphor, some sort of crucible. There is some sort of transformation, and fictional characters become themselves, and they are not the same as people. But one of the reasons I couldn't have written this novel sooner is that I think I had to reach everybody. It's not just that everybody has died of older generations in my family. It's also that I think for me to reach a point where I could see them or some version of them, an imaginary version of them, just as people, not as my people, but just as people. And so I think in that sense, I can't explain, it was a joyous experience for me to write this book. It was an effort to see, obviously, a fictional version of these lives, but to see clearly, warts and all, with love, right? In a sort of an exercise of Buddhist compassion, if you will, you know? Mm. Yeah.
You said just a bit ago that when you found this memoir, when you finally read it in its entirety, there was a sense that there wasn't a novel at first, but then it kind of came about. You know, you've written memoir, you've written in essays. I'm curious about What made you turn to a novel in order to write this, the novel form as a part of your plan for this book, right? Why not publish this simply as a memoir? What did a novel let you do with these characters?
There's Penelope Fitzgerald's novel, The Blue Flower, which is a really beautiful and wonderful novel, is about Novalis, and it has an epigraph from Novalis, which I will now mangle. literature exists to fill the gaps of history. So if my grandfather writes, there's in the first section of the, or the first 1940 section of the book, there's a scene that is imagined by me, but the bones of which are in his memoir, which is about being in Salonika, which is now Thessaloniki, in June of 1940, having sent his wife and children back to Algeria, and on the day of the fall of France, being invited to a having been invited beforehand to a reception at the Romanian consul's residence, and the Romanians were were known to be pro Axis. They were. I don't know if that at that point they had revealed themselves, you know, fully Nazi, but they were. But what he wrote was that the wife of the consul took him aside, and before he ever went into the party, and weepingly said, "You need to understand that we are my husband and I are with you. We love France. We have to do what we have to do because we are the envoys of our government, and if we don't, terrible things will happen to us." Anyway, so he wrote that, you know, that's a paragraph, and now it's a scene of, I don't know, it's some pages with, you know, details of what people are wearing and what the room is like, and I think that, to me, that's what fiction is in an ideal world. Okay, here's my fantasy. My fantasy is that in an ideal world, and I asked a neuroscientist, is this possible? And they said, I don't know. To create for you as a reader an experience, an imaginary experience so vivid that it lives in your memory as if you'd lived it. That is my aim as a writer. So you can't do that with memoir.
I love that, and I have a million questions I want to follow up, but one of the things that I thought was really fascinating is even as this novel is allowing you to kind of inhabit the consciousness of these other people and write through the interiority of Gaston or Francois or Denise, there's two people in this narrative that feature largely in the family but don't have these focal characters, that you choose not to inhabit their consciousness, and that is Lucienne, the matriarch of the family, and then Lulu, Chloe's older sister, who is Lucienne's granddaughter. I think I've got all of that correct. I'm curious about that choice on your part, the sort of limit to your authority as an author, and that choice to allow those two characters to continue on with their thoughts, maybe not eavesdropped on.
Absolutely. So Lulu's quite simple. I have a sister. She is alive. She has a life. She doesn't, I mean, I wouldn't presume to imagine a life for her or thoughts for her. She's read the novel. She says she loves the novel. Who knows if she loves the novel, right? but she very graciously said she loves
the
novel.
She's a good
sister. She's a good sister. But that was a very practical decision I made early on, you know, that before I started writing, that there were certain parameters. The decision not to have Lucienne speak or see things from her point of view is actually, I think there are lots of, there are various, and maybe not lots, but various aspects to that. And one is that she is in some way a cipher onto whom much is projected by pretty well everybody else. Maybe not Chloe so much, but all the others, and a sort of blunt and superficial way of putting it might be to say that in a profoundly Catholic sort of setup, which is what that was, she's sort of given sainthood. Do you know what I mean? So much of the sort of Mother Mary stuff is projected onto her. But I also think that it's probably true that person who as a person I knew only because she had dementia by the time I was really sentient. So I knew only much later through her letters, and they were wonderful letters. And in fact, she wrote letters to us in French when we were children, which I have some of now, and I they're wonderful. But I, you know, didn't really pay attention to them. Probably didn't have enough French to understand them when I was a kid. So, but I'm sure that's part of it. Also, is that I have absolute. Absolute is maybe a lot saying too much, but I have real confidence in the characters, all the other characters, and perhaps I wouldn't have had as much confidence in the creation of her, in the creation of her interiority. Mm. But I also, her outline is known to me by knowing the other characters, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. This novel feels, I'll get to this question, but this novel just feels so Wolfian to me. I'm struck by your description of Lucienne as this cipher, because the different parts of the novel reminded me pretty strongly, were so evocative of To the Lighthouse to me, that it's interesting to see her as a sort of Mrs. Ramsay sort of character as well, moving through this novel as this centrifugal force, and yet at the same time not entirely alive in the same way that all of the other characters are, or not portrayed with the same sort of intimacy as others are.
Right, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting. I wasn't thinking of Wolf, except there's an interlude in the middle where maybe I was thinking of Wolf, where I was thinking of Wolf.
I might be quoting it later.
but it's a funny thing. So I was asked earlier, last fall, to write a little introduction for the Yale Review. The Yale Review was opening their archive of Wolf pieces, of Wolf's essays. So in the 20s and 30s, they published about 9 or 10 Wolf essays in the Yale Review that they, you know, that most of the time have not been openly available to altogether to readers. And so they've started a new series online called From the Archive, and they asked me to. And some I was reading for the first time. But when I read these essays, I was so powerfully aware of how much my sort of literary understanding of the world had been shaped by her when I was young. Right, that a sense of sort of priorities and ways of thinking about things seemed really just. Well, cribbed from her in some way, and my father always used to say, "Culture is what's left when you've forgotten everything," and I feel as though there's this sort of maceration of the things that we read things and learn them, and then they get sort of mushed about like the leaves in the fall on the sidewalk in the rain, and we don't really know what's in there, but I was suddenly aware that she's very much in there,
very much. I want to come back to Wolf in a second, but I want to set her aside and think about another sort of patron saint of 20th century letters, which is the prologue, which is written in Chloe's voice and your voice.
Chloe's voice.
Chloe's voice, which is definitely not yours, but is maybe close to, begins with this statement that feels, I wrote it down because I don't want to get it wrong, that feels kind of provocatively like a manifesto in some ways. I'm a writer. I tell stories. Of course, really, I want to save lives, or simply, I want to save life. And this recalls to me the sort of really famous statement by Joan Didion, which is that we tell ourselves stories in order to live. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious that this is not this moment where we're telling stories to live, but to save lives, right? It's something that's happening externally, not for us as writers, but to do something else in the world. And so I'm really interested in what needs saving and why.
So I suppose I think I didn't, writing that, particularly intend, or only partially intended, save lives in the sense of, you know, like you might save someone from drowning. Although there's an Auden quote in there, the poetry makes nothing happen quote. So I mean, we do. Isn't that the dream, right? Is that you might write something that would make a difference in the world, and whereas maybe once people had that illusion, however briefly, somewhere, sometime, it's hard to have that illusion now, that literature can do that. But what I actually had in mind, I think, is some sense of like being a hoarder, trying to save life, trying to combat the ephemerality of our existences. And you know, my grandfather, with this memoir that he wrote for my sister and me, he called it "Everything That We Believed In," and that I think was very much in my mind as I embarked on this novel, because I came to the realization. So my grandfather, it's actually cited not properly in context, but in the novel, as the Second World War was underway, and he was worried that he and my grandmother might die, he wrote a letter that was to be opened by his children, who were then children, in the event of their deaths. And then they didn't die, so he kept the letter. And in that letter, he said, "This is what it's important for you to know. We are Mediterranean, we are Latin, we are Catholic, we are French," in that order. And so when I read that, and I'm a North American non-practicing Protestant, I'm aware that everything that they believed in is quite far from what I was brought up to believe in. And then I became aware, in the way one does, that what my children have, the world that my children now live in and what they believe is quite different from what, or what they think the world believes is quite different from what I was brought up to believe in. And, you know, one example I might give of that is that, I think we've sort of noted the bad stuff of a sort of late 20th century worldview and ditched some of the good stuff. And some of the good stuff was that in that post-war time, people really optimistically wanted to begin again and build a new world. And in that new world, I was brought up to believe by my parents, nuts that they were, that you know, boundaries would come down and things, the hybridity would flourish, and tribalisms would die, and that was the sort of progress we were making towards a beautiful future where everybody would get along, which for some brief moment, you know, for much of my life, but I think the sort of apotheosis for me was, you know, when Obama was elected president, and I thought, look, there's somebody whose life is as weird and confused and made up of as many disparate things as my life, and that person can be president of this country, and look, that's where this country is going. But my kids were little then, and 8 years later, the America into which they sort of came into awareness is a really different one, and one that it's not just America; it's the whole world. We're in a time of walls coming up and boundaries coming up and tribalisms resurgent and strongmen. You know, so part of, sorry, I'm talking at blue streak, but part of, I guess, what I hoped in the novel to convey is this sense of time, right, and how each of us, we live in our time and we're shaped by our time, and our beliefs are part of that time, and for good, for both good and ill, right? So that we struggle with the limitations, but also sometimes the great things about our time, but that those things will change and evolve, and that yet if we try to have some perspective and retain some sense of that evolution, that could be helpful in our lives, maybe. Mm.
Well, I love that. I mean, that's your literary fantasy, right? How can we possibly write a book or communicate in a way that would allow someone else's memories to be fully mine? But then also, as we see in this book, how could you possibly develop this sort of intense empathy, right? That you could inhabit the consciousness of someone else. I was looking here. I was not trying to rush you at all. I was thinking about this section that I think I had written it down. But now, of course, I can't find it. But I was so drawn by, in the passage where you're talking about Rushdie and about the the sort of radical secularism of the way that literature might communicate, might allow us to connect in a space that is both timeless and also timeful, that I thought was just really, really lovely.
Well, I think it was such a, you know, there's a section that's set in the late 80s when the fatwa was issued against Rushdie. And I think for many, I was young, it was just this like weird perspectival shift and this strange sense of different centuries in the world at the same time. So the idea that, the idea that my understanding of a novel, which was also, I think, quite close to perhaps his understanding of a novel, there were people, you know, on the same subway car, as it were, in the same city, whose idea of writing and what it could be and what it was for and how one might use it was completely different. And the lens was so different that they, as we know still now today, mm-hmm. would be prepared to kill him for it.
One of the things I thought was so interesting about this book is, you know, it spans from 1940 to 2010 with an epilogue in 1927, and it's been hailed as a post-colonial novel, which is, you know, inherently a term that is temporal, right? That's got a time based into it. It's after colonialism. And despite the novel's historical sweep, it's not particularly about the historical events that were transpiring in these characters' lives. It is really about these characters moving through the world against this backdrop. And so it had kind of a similar experience to much of The Emperor's Children, with the exception that at The Emperor's Children we have, like, wham, at the end, 9/11. This novel resisted that sort of really specific historical event, which marks it as quite different from a lot of historical fiction. I'm really interested in how you kind of, as a novelist, balance those two scales between the timeless and the timeful, and intimacy and love. I'll just cue you. This is kind of what I want to talk about next. Intimacy and love seems to be part of the way that you toggle between those two things.
I think novelistically, right, the nearest thing to life, going back to that Eliot quote, I also have in my head a line from Larkin: "Where do we live but days?" I mean, we live in history, all of us, and yet we live in days, and we live in families, and we live in. So I actually you wouldn't know it 48 hours later, but I had my hair blow dried in Toronto, and this very nice it was as if you know, the heavens had sent this nice young woman to me, and we were chatting, and she is Ukrainian and Italian, and she moved to Toronto to seek a better life. She had moved already because of the war from Ukraine to Italy, and then she moved to Toronto, and she said, and I said, "Do you have family still in Ukraine?" And she said, "Yes, my mother, she was in Italy with me, but she wanted very much to go back because that is home, and so she's there." And I said, "But she's far from the fighting." She said, no, she's not far from the fighting. The fighting, you know, 20 people were killed 10 minutes from her house. And then she said, and it's crazy, I speak to her on the phone, and she's laughing and, you know, making cakes and having friends around and dancing. And she said, "You read that kind of stuff in novels, and you don't believe it goes on. But where else are you supposed to, how else are you supposed to live? That's how you live." So that's how we live. And so that's what I wanted to write about, is how we live interacting with history, shaped by history, surrounded by history, and forgetful of history at the same time, right? And the only way sometimes to be able to go on is to forget about history for the day and worry about whether your child has, you know, lunch made or calling your mom to see how she's doing, you know. But that seems to me, if what I'm trying to do as a writer is convey something of what life is like, that's I think in my experience, that's what life is like.
Mm-hmm. I think related to the issue of timelessness, timefulness, was also a transience and permanence. And, you know, in as much as these characters are kind of moving generationally, they're also moving internationally, and yet looking for and kind of always eluded by this sort of permanence of love, right, and the permanence of home. And one of the sections that I loved that to me felt exceptionally Wolfian was towards the end, as Chloe is kind of packing up or at the her grandparents' apartment, and looking all around it, looking at all of these objects, and she gives this litany of objects. Every item was known to me: the photographs of us as toddlers, as teenagers, the ancient shower head in the bathroom of our girl's bedroom, and she's cataloging everything that's here, that's withstood the passage of time, but asking, what are we supposed to make of this place now that the people who were at that center of gravity are not here anymore? And she says, what would it all now become? What were these things without us brought together around them, having been repositories of history, of family, of a kind of private magic? Would they now simply become again things, the dingy, broken detritus of an anonymous past? If nobody lived here, if nobody opened the books, switched on the lamps, ate off the chipped plates, sat in the hard armchair by the window to watch the sea night and day in its ceaseless rhythm, then what was this place? And more urgently, without him in this place, he who had assured me when I was young that family was all that mattered, that family for their itinerant, certainly, and for those with no country, was home, who were we? I mean, this seems to me to be the heartbeat of this novel. Formally, I think it's a really beautiful encapsulation of what this novel is doing, this march of time, and yet also the solidity of intimacy, and the way that these things are ultimately always eluding us, are ultimately always kind of beyond our reach, no matter how we try to hold them and to grip them tightly.
I know. Doesn't it suck? I mean, I think that, you know, I said, I'm not a Buddhist, I don't know enough, but I said at the beginning something about an exercise in sort of Buddhist compassion, but part of Buddhism is not holding on, right, is understanding that everything changes and you have to let everything go. But that's so hard, and I think when you feel sort of storm-tossed in some way, which is the condition of this family, which was the condition of my family, but which I also think of as the condition of the 20th and 21st centuries for millions of people, right, is not to be living in the place where you were born, not to be surrounded by the people, maybe it's not tragic because she was elderly, but we very sadly lost Alice Munro yesterday, and mm-hmm. Alice Munro was somebody who lived in the much of her life in the town where she was born, and she knew everything about it, and she knew its history all the way back, and I'm sure she knew, you know, every brick in the sidewalk and every family. She's the granddaughter of, you know, I'm sure she knew all of that, and that's the fiction that she writes, and that, for so many of us, is not the gift that we're given, right? And Rushdie, in fact, wrote about this in an essay now long ago called Imaginary Homelands, where he writes about the fact that as soon as you've left home, you have only an imaginary homeland, because the place that you go back to is different, has changed. The place that you left is no longer there. And so you can have a love of place, and it will escape you, and of course, as human beings, that's also true. We're always trying to see clearly, trying to understand fully, you know, and yet we can't fully understand other people, you know. We can't fully see other people. We project our longings and desires, our fears, whatever. We project all sorts of things onto them, and also people are changing. So people are always, you know, it's like the river flowing, it's not the same water, it's not the same, You know, I think that a lot about long, I've been married now a long time. We got married in 1992. And we've changed so much and have, knock on wood, had the good fortune to change in ways that have remained compatible up till now. But people were always changing, so you never know.
Mm-hmm. One of the I won't spoil anything about this novel for you all because it's only been out a day. You may have not had the chance to get your hands on it yet. But I was so jarred, I think, by the ending of the novel, by this epilogue, which is the first thing that kind of formally breaks the, you know, linear trajectory of the novel, that we move from 1940 to 2010 and then 1927 there at the end. And it also reveals a secret that prompts us to really reconsider this relationship that is at the center of the novel, that is the sort of mythic fairy tale that each of the descendants of Gaston and Lucienne are reflecting on, are looking for their own version of the sort of magical love that overshadows them in some ways. And I thought for a while, like, why end this novel this way? But it made me then want to go back and reread it, right? That the sense that I had of having figured out this family, of having known at least kind of where the players were and how they moved was altered and revised in some really central way that I think really destabilizes the idea of plot. That really destabilizes the idea that we might be able to tie this narrative up nicely, that we might ever be able to really know someone, and gives it a sort of circularity in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. Yes. Well, that would, I'm glad.
That was a terrible question. But let me just tell you everything I thought about
that. But what I'd also say is that it for me, you know, it's also returning to that what we were talking about earlier, the sense that with the passage of time, perspectives change. So the Gaston and Lucienne character's perspective on this thing is really different from anybody else's and is shaped by their beliefs, right? And is and I think that's, you know, I think that's a thing that I feel so aware of in midlife, right? And when I was saying before, I couldn't have written this novel earlier because basically you want to sort of float up like a drone above and see what's shaping how people behave. So I'm not going to talk about the secret, but for example, colonialism, just to say, which is tied to this in my mind, it's hard for us now. In the same way that it's hard for my daughter to imagine that in my mother's generation, most women that you know who didn't have to didn't work, right? I mean, that's something that changed in the course of my mother's lifetime. But when my mother was married in 1957, it was you know, her husband assumed that if he could provide for her, she wouldn't work. So, you know, I always think of her. She was an ardent feminist but I feel like she was standing, she was too old, just that bit too old, and she was standing on the shore watching that sort of the boat of women's liberation saying, wait, I'll grab the kit, right? But, you know, but and so it's almost impossible for my daughter to understand that. And I think it's in a different way, it's almost impossible to understand that for my people of my grandparents' generation, born with the century, beginning of the 20th century, their colonialism was an unconflicted thing, right? That they felt they were building a new country, that they felt they were that they were bringing roads, education, you know, French Enlightenment values to Algeria, and it was a wonderful thing, right? And we don't see it. We see it very, very differently now. But there was also an interim generation, which is my parents' generation, that already saw it very differently, right? And you know, not quite the way we see it now, but in a much more, it was never without conflict. It was never it was never a sort of cheery, happy thing. It was always fraught and with an understanding that colonized nations must be independent, right? So that's in the span of 100 years, which isn't in the scheme of the world that long. This evolution, and it's very easy for us to think, oh, but we've sorted everything out now. In the same way we all think our parents never had sex. Like, oh, it's we've got it all sorted out now. And I think to myself, but people in 20 years will look and say, people got on planes to go for book tour? What the heck? Like, with the environmental crisis, just got on a plane? Like, that's insane. That's insane that people did that. And yet here we are, and I got on a plane to come here today. Right? So I feel like we don't know how it will change.
Hmm. And it's useful. This is my last point, but it's so interesting and useful to think about historical fiction as also projecting that future for us as well, as not only narrating a past for us, but projecting a future, however open-ended, but at least a way of being.
Yes, yeah. Yes, absolutely. But for me, it's just, I think for me, in a way, the key thing is that sense of this bigger arc, that sense that we aren't just in our moment, right? That there is a past and there is a future. And there's I'm very troubled by it because I think it's sort of true. There's a Valeria Luiselli in her wonderful Lost Children archive. There's a passage where she says something has happened. She published it in 2019. She says something has happened to time recently, and the future has disappeared. There's only the now. And I feel like if the future disappears and there's only the now, the past also disappears, right? It's a breakdown of everything. And I'm not going to get going on that little jukebox riff. But if you think about it, I mean, the strangeness of a virtual world in which, you know, the Instagram of dead people, right? And it doesn't go away. And it's still there. And that's quite weird. Because the past doesn't become past. The past is present. So there's the virtual, this sort of virtual echo. You know, in researching the book, the internet became a thing just in time for many pieds noirs Algerian colonials, French colonials repatriated, who put up. You can find essentially villages and schools and neighborhoods reconstructed online with photographs. You know, there's a virtual world of the world that vanished. I mean, that's sort of, when you're researching something, that's sort of amazing, but it's also kind of weird, right? It's also kind of weird, and I feel like we want to know about the past, but we also need the past to be past. We do.
Well, on that note, I would love to take some questions from the audience.
Do you think of your characters, not necessarily in this book, but in the previous books, as whole and independent of you? Or do you recall the struggles that you went through to produce them?
Are those mutually incompatible? I think it seems a little embarrassing to say that I think of them as there, and that I try to find them, but they're there. And then when I go away, in principle, they would still be there. Which sounds sort of like the internet. Which may not be a good thing.
Can you tell us, to the extent that you are able, the history of your grandfather's predecessors? I mean, they came to Algeria from France at what point? And when he listed his labels and you put Mediterranean as the first. So I would, based on that, kind of lean toward figuring, well, they were from the southern part of France, but how in his head did the resonating history of his family line up? It's just so fascinating the way he saw himself as Mediterranean before all those other things.
Right. So about which I'd say several things. One is that specifically my paternal family, but also the Pied-Noir community more broadly, was not simply French. So my own ancestors were French, Neapolitan, Majorcan, and Maltese. So they were all Mediterranean. And there was in French Algeria a social hierarchy of that. And, you know, French was the highest in that hierarchy, and Maltese was the lowest. So Maltese was closest to indigenous Algerian in that French hierarchy that you could be. So my surname is a Maltese name. It's a distortion of a very common Maltese name, which is Mifsud, as my father always would say, because it's Mesoud, but it's, people think it's Mesoud, and Mesoud means happy in Arabic, but unfortunately Mifsud means crook. so we're descended not from the happy people, but the crooks. But that, I think it's really something to see in the course of researching. You know, there are places that I went to, like Thessaloniki and Beirut, and of course places in the south of France. Toulon is where my father's family were, but I didn't go to Algeria, so but I've seen photographs, and all of those cities look the same, right? They all are laid out in similar ways. It's always the white buildings, it's always the palm trees, it's always the plazas, it's always the port. And that's a colonial thing in part, right? I mean, different iterations of colonialism, but I think that identification of the Mediterranean as a isn't it Brodel, the French historian, who's the guy who came up with the idea of la durée. I believe his one of his important texts, maybe his most important text, is about the Mediterranean as a sort of geographical, cohesively geographical place. And I think that's a whole other conversation that's quite interesting, because if you want to get, you know, if you want to then enter into, you know, whiteness, not whiteness, you know, the Mediterranean is a really interesting and complicated. I went to Sicily a couple of years ago, and we rented a house, and we're looking out on a little island where the Punic Wars were fought, right? You know, it's all just there, that history. And of course, Carthage, we don't know about Carthage because the Romans won. But Carthage, they were Phoenicians, which is what the Maltese also are, which is essentially Lebanese, Syrian, right? So the movements through history, I mean, parts of Sicily have a lot of Arabic cuisine and, you know, North African food and also words, language, right? Because the movements in the Mediterranean were such. That it was precisely that sort of, even with all their wars, it was a hybrid, porous world.
Quite anxious to read your book. I read the review in The New Yorker, and I'm glad I read that before I tried to tackle the book. I'm glad I heard you, too. Upton Sinclair took 13 novels to cover Lanny Bruce's history from the year 1900 to 1950. So my hat's off to you for, I mean, that was kind of pre-Forrest Gump. He did all the kind of stuff that met all the world leaders. But I'm really anxious to read this. You do that between the covers of one book. It's a tour de force.
Well, who knows if I do? I try, you know, it's like I was saying before, it seems, the other thing that besides the Martin Amis novel, I also keep thinking, this is years ago, back when Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman were still married, they made that movie called Far and Away. Does anybody remember? I never saw that movie, but I saw the trailer for it. It was about a couple who started out in Ireland and then came to the States in the 19th century and like went west and homesteaded and all of that. And it spanned like 70 years. And in the trailer, you could see that as the scenes progressed, they were putting sort of grease paint on their faces, like, oh, Nicole Kidman now has lines here. Oh, now we've sprayed her hair gray. And I remember seeing the trailer thinking, that is a dog. That movie's bad. That movie cannot possibly be good. So there is slightly that worry, you know, but here's another thing. I said to my editor in the beginning, I was like, I'm going to write five short novels. And she said, no, Claire, you're not going to write. You're not. You're going to write one novel.
Hi, Claire. So we were talking earlier about how we're all moving through the passage of time and we're all changing over this time. And I'm curious, as you reflect on this project and your career, how have you changed as a writer? And what has been sort of surprising or uniquely challenging about this project? Yeah.
It's very nice to see you.
How have I changed as a writer? This project was challenging in all sort, like I took a long time to get writing. I was, researching 10 years ago. So this figuring out how to tell it and, that took a long time. Way back in graduate school, the MFA program I dropped out of, there was one literature class, surely not, in which I read something about the first brain surgery in Canada. Do you all know about this? You have to be awake when they operate on your brain, and it was discovered that I hope I'm not making this up. but if I am, heck, that's okay. That if you put a probe in, like it's literally all in there. So in this initial surgery, the patient awake with the top of her head opened up, and then all of a sudden, you put the probe in, and she says, "I'm on a lake in Northern Ontario. It's August. I'm in a canoe. I'm with my dad. A bird goes by. I'm 12 years old, right? Like it's all just there. It's just all there." And so thinking about the form of the novel, like that was in the end what I was thinking about for the form of the novel. It's like you put the probe inside the brain and it's there, right? And it's just those moments are there and you don't have to, and then people can imagine whatever they want in between but that. But you asked how, you didn't ask that. You didn't ask that. Well, I think the scale of it, and then also this thing of writing about, I had always studiously avoided writing about real people. Indeed, it was mysterious to me. I published this novel, The Emperor's Children, and three women said to me, "Why did you write about my husband?" and I said, I didn't, and I really didn't. So go figure. But this time, I really did draw on, and so for me that was a sort of a hurdle to get over. But I also, I think I've to throw out a little French, I've reached a certain stage of je m'en foutisme in life. I feel like there's a line in Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things that recurs, where one of the characters keeps saying reviable diable age. And that character's like 32. And you know what? I'm a viable diable age, and I feel like it's now or never. And there we go. So you gotta do what you gotta do.
When I heard your novel coming out, I was kind of, talking about the past coming back, I was like, wait, this sounds like a novel that I've already read by her, The Last Life. And I wondered if you could just talk about maybe the similarities or the differences between the two, because they do sound really, really similar, and so I'm curious to see how they differ.
So, yes, I published 20 and a bit years ago, a novel, no, 25, 20, maybe the last century. It's strange because I'm only 27. A novel called The Last Life, which is set in the south of France. And having said just now that I studiously avoided writing things that could be connected to real people, that was a story about, I thought I was so clever, there was a family that my aunt worked for who had a series of dramatic events, and I thought I would make that family pied noir. And so I wrote about, from the point of view of a young woman named Sagesse, I wrote about the pied noir history, but also about this family. And then I showed it to my aunt, and she said, "Well, they are pied noir." Oops. Oops. But anyway, there's a locale, the south, the Toulon sort of aspect is a similar place. The families are quite different. The really a lot of the a lot of that novel is completely made up. And a bunch of this novel is made up, but the scale of this novel is completely different. So one of the things also that it there's a little bit of, I mean, there's a little bit in Algeria in 1940 and in the 50s, but there are lots of other places. You know, one of the things about, I often think about, maybe I digress, but there are also more characters, but a lot more characters in a way, or perspectives. My dad, I think of his experience as being as if you took he couldn't wait to get out of Algeria. And but I think it's a little bit like if you decided to take a rocket to the moon and then the earth blew up behind you and you turned around and it was gone, right? So it wasn't that he wanted to be there, or even, you know, it's just that he didn't think when he left that it would suddenly be gone. And so that that's an experience that my father's family had in as colonizers, right, as white colonials. It's also an experience that all kinds of people with all kinds of backgrounds have, and that they have to leave where they were from, and it isn't ever the same. And that's to some extent true of the lovely young woman who blow dry. Whatever that verb, like who did my hair the other day, right? Like the Ukraine that she left, the country that she left, she can't go back to. Whatever she goes back to, if she does, it'll be completely different. So in that sense, there's an overlap thematically, but the books are completely different. And I would say they're also different in the way that a 32-year-old and a 55-year-old are different. A lot more death, eh?
Well, Claire, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Thank you for chatting with us.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.